Hello and welcome to the Hardcast. Tonight, I'm your Hardcast host, Nick Mayo, joined by
Brendan,
Billy,
Jay McCowan.
And tonight, we have a little something special for you. We're going to be talking about our pre-modern data project. This is something that we've been working on for about past month or so. Mostly myself, Jay, and Brendan, who I have on the episode here. And we've been really wanting to look at the data on the MTGO scene, the leagues, the Swiss events, the playoffs, all of that. So we started this about a month ago, actually probably even longer than that, maybe about a month and a half ago. Brad said that he was kind of envisioning, like, what would it look like if we had matchup spread percentage in pre-modern? What does that look like? And how do we get there? And it was just something that he kind of threw against the wall, but I kind of thought, well, what if we went and got the data for the pre-modern leagues that are online? So I reached out to my friend Chris DiBiase, who runs those leagues, premodernseries.org, the CPL, also known as CPS, to see what kind of data we could get through gathering, and little did I know that we could actually get the data. So we made it. We made a matchup spread percentage. It's on data.derescrew.com. You should definitely check it out even during this episode. But I wanted to have these guys on because I kind of wanted to have an episode where we're talking about tying into the themes of the year review that we had, just our last episode. I wanted to have these guys on so we could talk about what it was like working together, what is our background, how did we come up with this, how quickly was it, what were the bumps, how do you FITFO figure it the fuck out, all these other topics. Dress Crew is filled with a number of technical people, including myself, Jay, and Brendan. We also have Trent, who's not on the line here. So this was like a really natural fit for us. So before I go on, did anyone have anything? You guys have anything for like?
Yeah. I'd love to just pop in real quick. Going back even further than a month or so, like, I've always been a very data-driven person, and I love looking at how to attack a meta. I think we definitely, like you said, Nick, we talked about this a bit on the podcast, on the Year in Review podcast, about like trying to attack the meta, trying to figure out weaknesses, holes, that you can really exploit with your deck selection, with your card choices. And I've always been a huge fan of, there's a bunch of different people on Twitter and stuff that will post meta matrices breaking down different moto formats. So, you know, especially, you know, during like modern season or standard or whatever, they'll break down current formats, going through all the challenges and everything, because you can just get so much matchup data from both moto and anything that's run through like Melee or whatever. But obviously I didn't really ever think about doing something like that for pre-modern, and I wasn't really familiar with, I don't play in the moto leagues, so I didn't realize that they kept a database of all of the matchups along with all the decks. So when we kind of started talking about, I think it really started with us realizing just how much data we had access to with the Gatherling API, and we kind of just started chatting about that, and then quickly that coalesced into a, well, why don't we make one of these matrices of pre-modern and start looking at, you know, probably nothing revolutionary in terms of the data, but at least get a figure of, you know, okay, so-and-so says that this matchup is favorable, and so-and-so says that it's not. Can we, where is the actual line on that? So it was a blast working on the project.
And just one thing I want to call out in this episode, if you hear us refer to Gatherling at all during this episode, for people who don't play on the Moto Leagues or anything like that, that is the website that they track, and they do all their pairings, deck registration, everything's through this website. So if you hear us say Gatherling, that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
One interesting problem we had right off the bat with some of this data is that on Gatherling, when you're submitting for a pre-modern league, you the, the person submitting the deck can name the deck whatever they want to name. You could submit Sly and you could call it Dreadnought if you wanted to. It doesn't have any impact to your opponent or anything, but for our purposes, when we're looking up decks, it's obviously kind of hard for us to classify something if it's called Dreadnought, but it's Sly or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So
I believe you also select an archetype, quote unquote, where it's like aggro control or
yep,
like mid range or something, and like that's it. It's
so I'm raising my hand here.
So polite.
So polite.
I was not named as one of the technical people.
I'm sorry, Billy. Billy's very technical, just not in programming.
Yes. So I'm here on this episode as the designated dummy. So I saw that I'm going to be asking some very high level questions, because I think that when I saw we made a channel in our Discord for this, everybody talks matchup spreads, and I thought I was going to be so involved. And I was thinking that I would be so smart and so useful. And I'm like, I like math. I can totally handle this. I'm good at Excel. I know how to ask ChatGPT all sorts of questions. I've taken a couple CS classes. I thought I would be quite useful for this. Absolutely not. Plain useless. So, dear listeners, if you hear me speak up, I'm the voice of you. So let me get this straight of what's going on. Duress Crew has a data analysis project.
Yep.
Right? And we are, y'all, royally.
Yeah.
We're scraping a bunch of data off the internet, and we're publishing it in the form of a matrix so people actually know what the fuck beats what.
Yep.
Okay. Cool.
Great summary.
Okay. And so I'm just I don't even know where to start, because I saw this all go through and it blew past me, and I made a couple edits very early to be like, oh, this is how you define Dreadnought. Contains card name Stifle and contains card name Dreadnought.
Right.
Does not contain Shallowgrave.
Yep.
And then I also had some flawed understandings of what efficient programming would look like. Cool.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so basically, Billy kind of touched on it there for a little bit, but basically, so to solve this problem of figuring out what decks are what, we effectively created this library that contains a bunch of different cases. So you might have a case for, let's say, Billy just said Dreadnought. Does the deck contain Dreadnought? Great. Does it contain Shallowgrave? That's probably not Mono Blue Dreadnought, right? That's probably, Angry Hermit or something like that, right? So we created these cases that say, if the deck contains this but does not contain this, it's this, right? And we did this for all of the major archetypes in pre-modern. To the best of our ability, I think we hit 85% accuracy or something. We had 15% of decks that were just what is this deck? We're never going to classify it. This is some guy's brew.
How many deck lists are we talking?
That's a great question. I actually don't know how
hundreds,
many.
Hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands?
I'll get back to you on that one. Brennan's going to look it up right now. Okay. So we did this across all of these decks and got all the matches, and I believe we're hovering around 6,000 matches for 2024, all the Moto. All MTGO happened this year, which are some great numbers. We still want more, but there's some great numbers. And so we've got a whole ton of decks that we've classified, we put up, and if it's above 2% of the meta share, it's displayed on our site by default. So part of this entire exercise, and some of the exercises that we've been doing over the past year and a half and so, required a lot of hands. Brendan is pretty new to the crew. This is first Hardcast episode. And it was really awesome to have him around because he did so much for this. But first I want to talk about Jay a little bit, because Jay has picked up programming as almost a side, I don't know, should I say hobby?
Yeah, it is purely a hobby right now, but it is something I've always been really interested in. I have an engineering background, and I spend way too much time on the computer, so it's like I might as well understand how this shit works. But it's something that's always interested me, and I love being able to... at the end of the day, it really is just I love learning. And
yeah.
I love being able to take a challenge or a problem and just, well, figure it the fuck out.
Yep.
So I think that if anybody is interested in learning anything, really, just not just programming, one of the best ways to do, like, you know, you can follow along tutorials, you can read textbooks or whatever, but, like, if you can find a project that you are at least somewhat passionate about and truly sparks your interests, you're gonna spend so much more, like, time and energy actually learning than any other method. So a lot of it, you know, I've been doing fucking Code Academy or whatever for, you know, on and off for a couple of years, but middle of last year, I really started working on a controller for our streams.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be able to easily update life totals, names, deck lists, etc., for our streams, and this was really even before we were really planning on, like, streaming the big regional tournaments. I just wanted to do, like, weekly jam sesh streams and stuff. And the whole project just kept growing and kept growing, and how I was integrating it with everything, and finally got it to a point that I was really satisfied with, and we've been using it for the past couple of regional streams. And it's totally... changed how, like, I learned more in those couple of months than I had in the past several years with regards to programming. So when we started doing this whole project, I was like, hey, I have some front end experience. I can try and put that to use and see how I can help out. And I'd say the end result I'm happy with.
Yeah, you definitely fitfoed it.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, and I was really excited to see you guys both, like, eating this up, because, you know, once I figured out we could get the data, I was like, okay, great, now I need to figure out the time of when I can do this, but you guys just picked up and ran with it. You guys went crazy on it. So, Jay, since you're, like, so passionate about this, you know, I always see you talking about the matchup matrixes mm-hmm. and other formats and everything. Where do you think this can go, and, like, where do you want it to go?
So I was trying to look at something real quick. Well, actually, here we go. Let me pause for one moment. Okay, yeah. So something that I think is pretty interesting for scale. For anybody that plays Magic outside of just pre-modern, you might be aware that this past weekend was essentially the return of GPs. Grand Prix, they're back for regular constructed Magic. I know most people that play pre-modern are probably groaning. They're like, I don't care. Sure.
Whatever. How'd you do, Jay?
I did not do well. It was not a good weekend. I was there. I had a blast. It was fun. It was a bad weekend for me for competitive Magic. Anyways, that GP was, I think, about 1,400 people. For context, the full data is now published from the Grand Prix, and people have made similar matchup matrix for standard. That single event generated about 6,000 matches. So if you're kind of curious on scale of where we're at, we're still pretty small. You know, we have the equivalent of about one large GP-sized tournament in terms of data.
And that's all of 2024.
And that took all of the year.
Yeah.
So I think if anybody is wondering where we want to go from here, I think the biggest, the best place that we can go is really just more data. People are, pre-modern as a format in some hands doesn't change a lot, but on other hands it really does. It does, you know, we've seen a lot of meta shifts over even just the past calendar year. I think the mono blue Stifleknot deck that Selden won LobsterCon with this past year has obviously been kind of a bit of a menace the past 3 months.
Yep.
We can look at currently the, you know, we're looking at, say, mono blue Stifleknot's win percentage over the past year, but when we start chopping that down to just the past 3 months, which might, you know, be looking at just the decks that play, that have been playing like the Tide package in the sideboard, we probably don't have quite enough data to really be providing enough insightful evidence to look at how well that deck has been performing. So I guess keep in mind that while this data shows some things, it might not show other things, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. That, you know, just as Mono Blue Dreadnought might have a 50-something percent win rate, 56% win rate with over the past year, it might be higher in the past 3 months. I think that'd be an interesting thing to look at. But yeah. Again, we need more data.
Right.
So what this comes down to is you, listener, how can you help out? Well, if you play in any events that are decently sized, I would say we're probably not super interested in, you know, four-person weeklies or no. whatever, but any decently sized event, if you can run it through Melee, Spice Rack, anything that basically isn't Companion, you can collect that matchup data, and along with deck lists, you can send it to us. And I think that's really important for us going forward, because the real place that we want to get this to is not being strictly just Modo data. If we could get this to be encapsulate all pre-modern data that we can get our grubby little hands on, we can keep growing it. And it really just comes down to the more quantity is quality in a way. I think I'm right in saying that it is, the more data we can get, the more accurate we can be in it, and the more granular we can be in how we can filter through it.
Yeah, agreed. Totally. Speaking of numbers, Billy's raising his hand, but Billy, 1 second. Brendan has some numbers on decks, players, and actual hard number of what matches we have so far.
Yeah, so like Jay said, we have basically the full calendar year of Magic Online events, and in all of those events, we ended up with about 2,800 decks, 6,000 or so matches, and 635 individual players. So for a smaller community format, that's a pretty good size numbers, but for like Jay's example, the actual data that we need to do any sort of reasonable approximation of like, is this really what a matchup is like, or is this just somebody played 3 matches and some coin flip stuff happened, or somebody got mana screwed or whatever? So yeah, we really need more data.
Agreed. Billy, you have something?
I have a bunch of... I want to pepper you guys with questions.
Let's do it.
Hit me.
All right. So explain this as you would to a very small and very stupid chat.
Almost like there are 5?
Yeah. Like... Talk to me the way that you've been holding back from talking to me since you've met me. All right?
Okay.
All right. So we want... Dress Crew says...
Like, how does it work, or...?
Yeah, I'm opening the hood of your muscle car. And ooh. I want you to explain to me how this works.
Where's the carburetor?
Do you want to take a swing at that?
Yeah.
Sure.
Brendan?
So, okay. So... Dress Crew says we want to make a matchup matrix, and we want to publish it. Where do we get the deck lists? I think that's where we get the deck lists is clear, but the way that like a web user experiences it is very different than what you're up to.
Yeah, absolutely. And step zero in this process is Gatherling making their API publicly accessible and allowing us to actually pull this data.
What is an API?
Yeah, we're explaining to a 5-year-old right now.
Yeah. So an API is basically a way that a website will get data, more or less. That's the easiest way to put it, is it takes the data from whatever program is running and it allows you to view it on your web page.
The way I would describe an API is like when you pick up the phone and you call a pizza place and you order a pizza, that's an API to the pizza place.
So Gatherling has a bunch of deck lists just in its somewhere on the Gatherling part of the internet that is Gatherling.com that has somewhere like a huge file folder full of deck lists. And there's like a player name and a deck list and probably that player's who else that player played and then like a match outcome, right?
Yeah, and the league is very important, right? Because you might play in multiple leagues, right?
Yeah.
So you're not always playing the same deck.
Okay. So what we are doing is we made an internet robot to talk to the Gatherling internet robot and to speak in robot language and say, hey, will you please show us your books? And we asked nicely, and we actually did ask Gatherling.
Yep.
It was Chris, right? It was Chris.
No, so Chris was basically like, hands up, I don't know anything about
that.
He basically went, I don't know anything what you're saying, Nick. Yeah. Like, here's the guy to go talk to.
Okay.
I only have a screen name. It's like Baker. It's like Baker Rat. Sorry if I get it wrong, but I don't know him personally.
Okay.
But he's like the admin for Gatherling.
Okay.
And he basically pointed me to like, yeah, go hit our API. We don't care. It's open.
Okay. So did we download an entire copy of the Gatherling match history?
Effectively, yeah.
Yeah, more or less. Not in exactly the same format. We kind of made a few modifications here and there to allow us to perform some sort of calculations and so on that's not in the original data, but more or less, yeah, it's 95% exactly what they stored it as.
So we are not performing the calculation using their data set. We took their data set, downloaded it, and perform our own calculations on it.
Exactly.
Precisely.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Okay. That makes sense. Is Gatherling the only source?
It's our only source currently.
Okay. But we're talking to other people, right?
Yeah. So I'm also currently working on trying to get European champs data in. I have the match data. I don't have the decks. I have players' initials, thanks to European GDPR laws. for those who don't know what that is, Europe respects its users and has a lot of data privacy. So instead of people's names, I was sent initials. So we're working on trying to get the actual decks for those so that we can run it through our classifiers so we can make sure that all the archetypes line up. Because one of the biggest challenges that we're already seeing is at European Champs, we have the match and we even have archetypes, but they took all the Dreadnought data and just stuffed it into one thing called Stifleknot. Which for matchup percentage things matters a lot, right? Stifleknot is not Stifleknot.
Yep.
That's one source we're working on. I'm working on trying to get LobsterCon side event from last year. Again, I have the match data. I'm working on the decks. They were registered separately than what I was managing at LobsterCon, so I'm working on that. But going forward, we're going to be getting Gatherling as the leagues happen, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So this data is going to keep growing already by itself, and we're going to be incorporating our regionals because we're going to start using Spice Rack so we can actually export match info and use that, and LobsterCon this year as well. So for starters, we already have some stuff in the pipeline. We're just not at those events yet. I'm gonna bother the Rochester Royals for their data when we go to their event later this month. So we're already finding ways to grow it, which is obviously the goal.
Yeah, and I want to say that people who are listening to this might be asking, well, why can't you go on TCDex or whatever site and grab the data there? And there's definitely value in doing that in terms of seeing the frequency of certain cards or certain decks that are being played. But really what we want to do is add even more insight on top of that. And the two things that we really need are round by round pairings, who played against who, and we also need the actual deck list themselves. So that those are really the two main things that sometimes we have one and sometimes we have the other, or sometimes we're missing both. So that's really the part that we'd like to ask people in the community to help us out with, trying to keep some better track of that at their events.
Yeah, and I guess it is worth noting that if you're just a regular player, there's not too much that you can do to You know, like, short of pestering your TO and being like, hey, you know, don't use Companion, use something else so that we can get that data. There's not too much that the average Joe can be doing. And also, just to piggyback on that, yeah, like, the TC Dex and MTG Top 8 provide great data, but they don't have, you know, just because such and such a deck won an event doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't give us the insight into exactly who they played against and, you know, what they won and lost against. We just know that, oh, this deck, you know, finished in sixth place or whatever, which is valuable data, but just not exactly what we're looking for.
I have more questions.
Sure. Please.
So now we have some sufficient body of data, and how show me with your hands how big this data is. Okay, so you're
well, Jay just did like a little small thing for the listeners.
I did what the ladies do whenever they're talking about.
Like he's pinching over. Yeah, right. so like. It depends on context, right?
Yeah.
If we were to compare this to something like Legacy, forget it. This is a sliver.
Got it.
You know, for pre-modern, this is pretty huge, right? This is all of the matches on MTG. Like, it doesn't have the casual lobbies, but
So
that's totally separate.
I guess a couple of numbers just to provide context for this. If we're talking about there's a couple of ways to slice it down. We can look at a single archetype and just what their raw win-losses across all matches that archetype has played. So, for example, a lot of you motherfuckers like to play Sly on Modo. So, Sly is our most played deck in terms of matches, and Sly has a 425 wins and 412 losses for a 50.8 win percentage. So, not bad. I would say, at those numbers, that's pretty sufficient. You know, I would say that the... I haven't actually calculated out the confidence intervals, but it's pretty accurate at that point. That, like, Sly hovering around a 50% win rate. And obviously 400, and, you know, 400 by 400 seems like a good amount. But then when you realize that we have maybe 30 or 40 well-played archetypes that are represented, and you start really breaking it down, you know, we only have, let's find a smaller one, you know, Sly versus Enchantress is 16 wins and 29 losses. That's not that many games played. So that's 45 matches.
Yeah.
That's not nearly enough to get a fantastic amount of confidence behind that number.
That could be like one Sly Stan versus one Enchantress Emma,
right?
Who just keep pairing into each other because they're both in the same time zone, and like maybe one person just like fundamentally does not understand the matchup.
One of the challenges with some of this data, and it's a plus for pre-modern, but a challenge for data, is that there's so many goddamn decks in this format that you go, wow, 6,000 matches? Well, if you have 6,000 matches in something like Modern, where, like, you know, 3,000 of them are Boros Energy, you know, that's a lot better than pre-modern, where it's like, whoa, holy smokes, 6,000, and then it's like, oh, wait, this I only have 200 matches of this deck, you know?
And I should say that it drops off very heavily after Sly. You know, you get down to even a pretty... You know, what most people would consider a popular, very well-performing deck in, like, Red Green Oath Bonza, only 332 matches. So, not a ton. You know, still a good number, and I would say that the overall win percentage is pretty accurate. But you start looking across, and, okay, well, Red Green Oath Bonza versus Terrageddon. We have 11 matches or so.
Right.
So, it's not nearly enough to say with any definitive precision that a matchup is, you know, a 60-40 matchup or whatever. I think to get back to what your question was of, like, how big is this data, it's deceptively big in certain areas and deceptively small in others.
You have any other questions right now, Billy?
Oh, I have a bunch of questions. I just don't want to like blow up the episode.
No, go ahead.
So, some of them are. So what you're a lot of these are like that scene in Zoolander when they're like the data is in the computer. So this is a fundamentally different process than web scraping, right? Or is it web scraping?
Yeah, it's. I guess I would say. Web scraping is generally when you look at the actual text that's on a website as if it were like you were copy-pasting something out of a book and sort of rearranging it. Yeah. This is a little bit lower level than that, and it's actually talking to the website itself and like reading the code. Yeah. Okay.
I think probably the best way to look at it is that web scraping is generally what you go to as a solution if you don't have an API.
That's what I was thinking, web scraping is something of an API, but is, like, entirely unofficial. So it's an API pretend while you're pretending to be a human.
If you have a bunch of data and you want to make that data pretty, you build a website that will take that data and then present it in a more presentable format. Web scraping is generally taking that prettified data and then almost putting it back into its original form.
Okay.
Whereas what we're doing is just directly talking to the Gatherling API and saying, hey, just give us that data, which Gatherling so graciously did.
I would describe the difference as like if there's a warehouse of stuff,
An
API would be me calling the owner and saying, what do you have in your warehouse? And then he would tell me what's in the warehouse.
Yeah.
Versus web scraping would be like I call him and say, hey, what do you have in your warehouse? And he says, fuck off, dude. And I go, okay, I'm going to go peek in the window, and I'm going to figure out what's in the warehouse by myself.
Got it. Okay. Interesting. So you had said that one of the issues was I had been using the phrase speciation, which is, I think, a very technically correct word for a entirely different environment. I think I picked it up from watching like AI ecosystem videos of just like for any Bibites fans out there of so how do you go about if there's like a million assholes out there naming Dreadnought their slide deck they're calling it like Billy Geddon or whatever and you're like that's Terra Geddon. I'm like no it's Billy Geddon. what is the process? You have a huge data set of deck lists, mm-hmm. and you've got a name, and you've got like a match history with other players, and you can probably connect those to other like a match outcome with two deck lists. How can you describe for me the process by which you correctly identify? Like, I would like to actually get a little bit more granular on this.
Yeah.
Like so I can. Yeah.
I think the first step was take the deck name that the user provided, throw it out.
Okay.
Just get rid of it.
Okay, that's called data hygiene, data cleanliness. Is there a name for this?
Normalization. Kind of the industry term.
Okay, getting everybody to speak with the same accent.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay. And that was just clutter that we could just get rid of. And then figuring out how, and this was a topic of discussion for quite a while, of how do we want to delineate between decks? I think MDG Top 8 does a pretty good job of breaking down the meta, but there are certain areas where certain decks, I think, do deserve to be more differentiated amongst themselves. So, for example, I think MDG Top 8 just has Oath of Druids decks, which is a little bit broad, but does do a good job. I mean, another one, it just has goblins. Now, in my opinion, red-green goblins is so prevalent that we would have 98% of goblins decks, and apologies to the guy who just won the Facebook Monthly, I think, with red-black goblins.
Yeah.
With Living Death?
Yeah.
But that guy's fucking cool.
I agree. But I think it's okay to just pile that in under goblins. Because if we... I think the best... way of breaking it down is that if you split out an archetype and that new archetype would have nowhere near enough data to be at all enough to care about, then it's probably not worth splitting it out.
Yep.
We had a ton, obviously a lot of people like Stifleknot. We had a ton of Stifleknot matches. We could split out Mono Blue and Blue White. And we had enough to provide tangible data on each. I think we chose to not split out Blue Black Stifleknot, correct?
Oh, we did.
Oh, we did?
Yeah,
okay.
We did.
It just had a smaller share of the meta. But it was... So I think a lot of it came down to just, like, how... And I'll probably get flack for this, but how real of an archetype... Mm. How many people... You know, how common is that archetype? Again, goblins, I think you can just leave it at goblins.
Right.
You know, is the one guy that just won with red-black goblins going to be like, how dare you? Maybe. But you know what? If enough people pick it up and that red-black starts becoming significantly different from red-green and is worth differentiating, it'll show up eventually.
So I is it better to keep in red-black goblins, or is it better and lump it in with red-green all under the goblins archetype?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it better to sieve that out and just disregard it as if it just never happened?
So we're definitely not ever going to ignore stuff like mm-hmm. that. I would say that our catch-all is not to ignore certain decks, but we just kind of group them together as rogue or unclassified, and then as they become
other,
yeah, exactly, and as they become more prevalent, then we can carve out a special category for them. But I would say in general our philosophy is to prefer to have more archetypes rather than less, and that way you can always go back and group similar ones together when you present the data. But you can't really go in the other direction if you're not getting more specific. So I would say that in general, if you had to flip a coin and it was 50-50, we would prefer to have more archetypes than fewer.
For sure.
Okay. So there are cases... Okay, so like MTG Top 8 has like Parfait-style Oath decks lumped in with Red-Green Oath.
Yep.
And did... We choose to separate that.
Yes.
Okay.
So yeah, it's hard to give a sort of scientific, you know, breakpoint at which you can say something is separate or not. A lot of it is just kind of intuition from us all playing the format. But yeah, generally, if it's a significant enough, there are two things. If it's kind of subjectively significantly different than another deck, and also is it really common to have those two distinct formats. Like Jay was saying, if there's something that's maybe 1% of an existing archetype that has a slight variation, it's probably not big enough to break it out. So it's a judgment call at the end of the day.
So in the case of, say, like green-white versus green-red Oath, in my mind, as an Oath Ponza player, they're the same deck. They're the exact same deck. It's just like, do you want to sweep up goblins or do you want to snipe dreadnoughts? That's the only appreciable difference between the decks. Even though, like, let me think. So you got the fetch lands, the pain lands, and then you're either running swords or you're running pyroclasm and naturalize. So there's 12 cards, which is a fifth of the deck.
Mm-hmm.
That's in terms of like card line items or even just card count, that's fairly significant.
It's probably more of a difference than the difference between like mono blue and blue white traditionally.
Yeah. But in that case, they're the same to me. Are they the same to the data project?
So I think it just matters how many green whites we see, because green red's obviously more popular.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But and I don't have the numbers in front of me. But if green white is 0.something%, probably just lump it in with green red, honestly, because we've played the format enough to know that there's gonna be some differences, right? But not enough to justify it. As we get more data, then yeah, we can split it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, it really largely comes down to the amount of data that we have, because if we split it out and green-white is, you know, a 75% win rate, but it's got, you know, four matches or whatever,
mm-hmm.
like, it doesn't really do a ton for us. You know, it doesn't tell us that, oh, it's better than green-red, because... Yep. Green Red has 300 matches.
That being said, to answer, to be specific, I do think we are splitting those out in our database right now. I just don't think it shows up by default because it's less than 2% of the meta.
Got it. So, hang on. Why? What is the significance of 2%?
So, the main reason for 2% is actually no mathematical or statistical reasoning. Because that's Billy's wheelhouse. That's not my wheelhouse. But it's more for a user experience because these kind of charts don't scale incredibly well as you have too many things on it. Like, you're going to be scrolling all the way to the bottom of the page, left or right. It just doesn't look that great. So we're just defaulting to 2% right now, just for viewership reasons.
Okay, so you took a... You set a value, and you said 2%.
Yeah.
Well, I think, actually, to back up, I think what we did first was we printed out... We looked at all the archetypes, and we printed out what each one was... with its percentage of the meta. And we kind of looked at it, and 2% was... obviously, the further down you go, eventually you get to a point where you're like, is that really a deck? You know? And at about the 2% mark was kind of where there was a... not a massive gap, but there was a jump between, like, that's definitely a popular played deck, and, okay, now we're into the bruise section.
Or even like previous flavors of the month, right? Yeah. Like people don't really play green. Like Green White is a great example because people, it's here and there. You're not going to see it.
Yeah.
But it's definitely not at the forefront of data.
So to use, let's say Greater Good Combo, that is a deck with a very clear known identity.
Yep.
It's as old as the hills. It is played with some frequency. I don't know what that frequency is. It sucks. So did we, again, Royal we, did you guys, did y'all choose to like, that's like a case of like a really clearly defined, and it's like, does your deck have greater grid or doesn't? Like, that's a very clear case of a rogue deck. Did you choose to identify decks that are like that?
Yeah, if there's a really namesake card, like Lightning Rift is another really good example. Like, it's not a deck that sees a ton of play, but it's so easy to classify that we just did it anyway.
Okay.
So there might be decks that don't have huge meta share, but as long as they're really easily identifiable, like, say, Zombie Infestation or something like that, something that has, like, really kind of a namesake card, then we did prefer to categorize those. Really, the catch-all rogue section that we were talking about before is really for decks that overlap so much with cards in other decks that it's really hard to say what one thing that it matches with because it might be blending like three things together.
Were there any decks that like I'm trying to okay so like EDH is something that you could have like an archetype and you only got 99 cards. And you have as many as 99 like line items. So you have your commander, and there might be 400 cards that would legitimately stay in the archetype. Like let's say Clothis Land Destruction for your 1v1 EDH deck. Like there's a million different stone rains. Like you might be playing Crack the Earth, and another person might be playing Solfatara. How do you protect, or do you just suffer from decks that have like a very large spread? Like Terrigen. There's five color, there's four color in every combination. Artie's fucking with Junkgeddon. I hear he's doing okay. I'm on a flavor. Other like Rich Shea was messing with like City of Traitors. What do you do with a deck that has like a huge spread of like some people are in Cataclysm and not Armageddon, you know?
Yeah, that's really the hardest problem in this sort of matching that we've come up with is that it's deliberately very simple. It's not super complex. It just is looking for certain cards, and we also have a step that will determine cards that are likely to be conflicting between certain archetypes that share them.
Nice hiss.
So in our case, something would be like, how do we determine a mono blue dreadnought from blue white dreadnought? Well, Edorka Waste exists in the deck, so we have a second step that says, okay, if it has Edorka Waste in it, it's obviously not mono blue. So that works the vast majority of the time, but in your example, there are plenty of decks that have interchangeable pieces, so to speak, that are not good fits for this sort of process. So a lot of the rogue decks are either ones that are sort of mashups of archetypes or ones that just have, like you said, maybe, you know, seven interchangeable types of slots. And it's really just for the beta version of what we have, it just wasn't something that we spent time to try to narrow down that extra 1% of decks or something that we could have refined.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I mean, if we say for Terrigen, and I don't know the exact, includes and conflicting cards, but if it includes Armageddon, if it includes Terravor, and if it doesn't include Oath of Druids, then we're going to stick it into the Terrigen category. And if somebody comes along that is completely subbing out Cataclysm for Armageddon, at the end of the day, the initial system is going to classify that as a rogue deck, or just kind of flag it. And it does mean that we might have to hand sort it. But, like, at the end of the day, as long as 90% of the stuff gets sorted automatically, it's not that big of a deal to have to go through and say, oh, this guy's just playing Terrigen, but with Cataclysm, we can we can manually sort it into the Terrigen bin, even though the program didn't initially do that for us.
So this was something that probably one of the most passionate.
We'll call it. Yeah, I think that's a good term.
One of the most passionate interactions that I've ever had during daylight hours with Nick Mayo.
Yeah, Billy and I really butt heads over this.
Yeah, we're plenty passionate in the evening, but during the day, I was astonished, absolutely fucking astonished, and this is like a naive point of view, is that you would rather do a manual flag than add another layer of, I would say, sophistication.
Yeah.
But you would rather do a manual flag than, like, come up with another, like, I don't know, another logical... So I like the logical operators. If, and, nor, exclusive nor, all that stuff. And I thought it would be clever to say, like, well, if it contains Terrivore and Mox Diamond and, parentheses, Armageddon or Cataclysm, close parentheses. But y'all were pretty intolerant to that.
Yeah, well, and it's part of it is, at least from my end, I'm very intolerant of technical debt.
What is technical debt?
Technical debt is a concept where it's like, hey, it can go two ways. Hey, I'm gonna take a shortcut right now in my development and I'll just deal with it later. Don't worry, it sucks right now, but I can do this way quicker. My boss wants me to do this quicker, I'm just gonna do it this way. Or it can be overdevelopment of something that you'll remove later.
Okay.
So technical debt is really bad because you build it up, your program runs slower, your thing's running less efficiently, you're spending more man hours supporting or fixing things, and then you 6 months later you have to go and go, oh, we haven't used this case in 3 months. Someone has to go do that, right? Yeah. And then you have to start weighing, okay, is that more or less work than just sticking into a bin and Jay checks it every, couple weeks or whatever. Whoa. Hey, you volunteered to do this, all right?
I did.
You go and just say, oh, that's Terrigen.
Got it.
You know? So I'm extremely intolerant to that, maybe a little too much. But I don't know if you guys had anything to add to that.
You are a famously intolerant person.
hold on.
At least people don't know what I was typing in the Discord chat earlier. Yeah. That was intolerant.
Seven people are typing dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
I would say that the biggest factor for me, and I very much align with Nick's philosophy on this, is I'm not really that smart. And if I go back and look at something I did a month ago, I might not even remember why I did it. So preventing yourself from getting in that case in the first place often makes it easier to go back and fix stuff when you don't need to reverse engineer a million things.
And then on the flip side too, in defense of it, if Jay comes to us and goes, guys, this is the fifth Terrigen deck I've done this month, you know what I mean, can we just add another case? Then yeah, we'll do it then.
Got it. Okay, so he's like, if he looks in his to-do bucket and he says it's time to add
right,
to consider the Cataclysm instead of Armageddon.
And maybe Terraclysm just becomes its own deck, and like enough people are playing that that it's just worth adding another line as, you know, this is a new deck.
Okay.
Cool. So I think being, I very much am of the opinion to just like keep it simple and Word. Just if you're building in complexity somewhere that it doesn't necessarily need it, then maybe just try and keep it simple and get as much, you know, if we can get 85, so there's a good quote about doing, you know, the percentage of work that you want to be doing for the percentage of
80-20
rule? Yeah, the 80-20, yeah.
In consulting, we call it the 80-20
yes,
rule.
Yes, that's what I was thinking of. But yes, that we want to be doing as much as we can for as much as we can, but not spending all the time in the weeds just to get the edge cases.
Got it.
Yeah, because what can happen is if you focus on the 20%, the 80% suffers.
Got it.
For the stuff you're doing for it.
Word.
That's a very good point, because our sort of matching algorithm, the more complexity you add to it, the harder it is to not mess up existing decks,
exactly,
so to speak. So you have to be careful to not overcomplicate things too much.
Cool.
You guys want to take a break and talk about dinner and talk about some outcomes?
Let's do it.
Yeah. Actually, I got one quick question.
All right.
So since you're our 5-year-old here.
Yes.
I actually have a question for you to explain to the viewer.
Okay.
So if viewer, and you can look along at the website. Why are some of the squares grayed out?
Using my 5-year-old's intuition.
Yep.
I think that some of the sum of squares, that's funny. The sum of squares. I think that some of the squares are grayed out.
Okay.
Because I think that represents a case of the mirror match.
Mm. And what is the win percentage of a mirror match?
Definitionally?
Yes.
50%.
Oh, okay.
Did I answer the question?
You did answer the question, and I hope you, dear viewer, also understand.
Okay, cool. We're going to take a break. We're going to pee, crack a couple more beers, and then we're going to talk about the delicious dinner I cooked. And some of the matchups.
And some interesting data.
Hell yeah. Okay, we're back after a short break. We're going to change the topic a little bit. We're going to talk about dinner.
Hell yeah.
This episode's recipe is Australian dry rub.
Hell yeah.
Why is it Australian, Billy?
It's named after a sex move.
Oh. Can you demonstrate?
Okay. Yeah. So, all right. So this episode's recipe is, I made it up. It's a Billy Mills Kern original. So what you do is you take a chicken. This is very good for if you know that you're going to host your friends the day before. So this is a PM meetup approved recipe.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Do a thumbs up.
Yep. So what you do is you take a chicken. And this scales very, very well, because you can oftentimes fit two chickens on a big deep dish baking pan. So what you need for this for equipment is a deep dish baking pan, like a 2-inch rim on it. You take a chicken and you coat it in your favorite flavored salt. So Old Bay, Lowry salt, adobo, it doesn't matter. Any sort of salt-based seasoning, mm-hmm. multi-purpose seasoning. Qdoba. Would that work?
Is that how you say that? I always say Qdoba.
Qdoba. Yeah.
That's I thought that was a restaurant.
It's a burrito place.
Oh, I'm conflating something. I'm an idiot.
It's okay.
Yeah, whatever. Doesn't
matter. That's how easy this recipe is, folks.
Yeah, that's how you can be as brain dead.
This guy made dinner for it.
Yeah. And what you do is you take that chicken and you fuck it with as much of that stuff as will stick on all surfaces. Get it in the armpits, get it in the thighs, get it all over it, and just complete until salt doesn't stick anymore. And then you stick it in a bag. And the fruit bags from the grocery store, those thin fruit bags, are perfect for this.
Yep.
Really?
Yeah. And then you just put it on that pan and you leave it in the fridge for a day. So when your PM crew says, who's hosting? Whose turn is it to host? You go, it's tomorrow. I'll deal with it. This is very, very easy. And you don't do anything the fuck else to it.
That's it.
Until you cook it for any, you know, depending on the size of that bird. Anywhere, 1.5 to 2.5 hours. It'll take longer if you got two birds in there or if it's a big bird. And then just leave it to cook. And what it is it's dry brining. And it makes the most succulent, moist, not dry at all chicken. Just dry brining in its own juices and salt. And it does something chemically. I don't know. I haven't read Salt, Acid, Heat. I haven't read that book, but Nick tells me it does something to it.
Chemically, the salt on the skin drives the moisture inward, not outward.
Got it. Okay.
But no shit, that is like one of the juiciest chickens I've ever had in my life. Thumbs up.
So the way that you serve this up is that you can take any sort of like... So in my mind, there's like sort of hardy vegetables, and weak vegetables. So weak vegetables, tomato, cucumber, zucchini, they all just fall the fuck apart. And then there's hard vegetables, carrots, potatoes, squash, onions, stuff that will structurally hold. So like, I don't know, thick cell wall versus thin cell wall.
Yeah.
So you take your baking pan and you just fill it up to the rim with the veggies. And this can serve as many people as you need. So just like fill it up with like carrots, squash, pumpkin, potato, onion, whatever. You don't need to season it at all. And you just fill the pan up to the edge with those like rustic, tough as nails vegetables. And they will cook in the chicken fat. It is so decadent. And it is so good. It is just like chicken fat, seasoned veggies.
So good.
Yeah.
And it's cheap, too.
It's cheap. It's cheap. It's very easy to do. Because you get home from work and you're like, fuck, my friends are going to be here in an hour. And just chop up some veggies. You don't need to season them. Don't need to put oil. The chicken fat will take care of all that. You just throw it all in the oven. 375. 1.5, 2 hours. You're good.
Whoa, you did 375?
Yeah.
It's kind of low, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, it got there. How'd it come out?
Oh, it was delicious.
I'll tell you in 3 days what I have salmonella. Yeah.
So, you can kind of tech this out if you want. You can stuff the bird. I like to stuff the bird with apples and celery.
Yep.
If you want to control the skin texture, like if Mike Coyle is coming to your house and you know he's going to eat all the chicken skin, you can put tin foil over the top of it and let it cook low and then crank up the heat and pull the tin foil off to get it cooked all the way through but give it a nice crisp. It's an easy one, and I'm going to put the recipe in the show notes.
Thumbs up.
So, yeah, so can I get a review from you guys?
Oh, 5 stars. Are you kidding me?
5 stars?
10 out of 10 hearty vegetables. Hardy.
It's like a Viking's meal.
Yeah, the wind is like 50 miles per hour outside right now, so it was the perfect meal.
Excellent. Excellent.
Thanks, Billy.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Dad.
I keep feeding this to you guys, and you guys keep eating it. Yeah. Yeah. And then you can send the chicken carcass home with one of your friends if they want to make soup with it.
They make some stock with it? Yeah.
Yeah. Pick it clean. Yeah. Cool. So this concludes this episode's De Recipe. The recipe will be in the show notes.
All right, guys, we're back from our break. While we're on our break, I wanted to ask Brendan because he has some thoughts around the kind of like philosophy and the impact of the format on this, because I think some folks are going to see this project and kind of have, you know, maybe even concerns or, you know, negative feelings towards it. And I think Brendan has some really good ideas about it. So,
fuck you.
Fuck you. You're spoiling the format.
Yeah. All these spikes are ruining it. No, there's been a lot of discussion about various cards being too good and...
Tied.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of them, for sure. Go read the Facebook thread that has 300 comments on it. But really, the goal here is not necessarily to make people feel like, oh, I'm not playing a 56% win rate deck, like I'm some scrub, or like to make people enjoy the format any less. Really, the goal here is to actually give people data that they can use to actually attack the more popular decks. So you might have a deck that you played a year ago or so, and due to a meta shift, like, you just kind of put it on the shelf, but you find that oh, in the last, you know, X months or whatever, like, these decks are really popular, and hopefully it's an aspirational thing as opposed to a, like, the sky is falling thing.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that we make that distinction, right? Because we're trying to do this to help people. We're trying to give people the ammo they need to actually have something to stand on besides vibes or besides, like, their individual experience. Pre-modern is an extremely unique format due to its size and its regions and metas and, like, different areas and who's playing what and all that. So we're trying to kind of, like, take all this data that we're finding and getting into one spot, because you always hear, like, there's not enough data, there's no good data. Well, someone has to take the first step, and that's what we're doing.
And I will say that, to your point about metas, is even just our project is only one specific metagame. Like, we have a fair amount of data for the size of the format, but it only reflects what's actually played on Magic Online, and there's plenty of live paper Magic going on that we have no insight into. So even for the small but somewhat reasonable sample size we have, don't draw too many conclusions from just that, because we need more representation of other areas.
Yeah, like, there's a couple times where I've wanted to use our data in conversations, but I try to have discipline because it's just not as developed as we like it to get, as we've mentioned several times already. So yeah, we did have some ideas going forward in terms of enhancements and things that we'd like to see in this going forward. We kind of are considering this a beta, or even just a proof of concept to get out there so people can actually see what we're doing, get a visual idea of what we're doing, and maybe draw a minor amount of conclusions from it. So some of the enhancements that we considered were expanding the meta share. So right now, like I mentioned a couple times, it just defaults to 2% meta share. We would like to give users the opportunity to say, I don't care about how big and ugly the chart gets, I want to see all the decks, or I want to see less of the decks, maybe you want to see 3%. A query builder was one that I had in mind, where you're able to actually draw conclusions from queries that you could actually make into our database from this interface without having, you know, full-on database access. And maybe some ideas in terms of, like, card win percentage, like what cards are winning, what decks are winning. We already have the decks winning, but, like, what cards going into which decks are winning. And then being able to filter by events, because, like, right now we have MTGO data, but we could eventually start flagging our data for different events. So if you want to say, well, how did this deck perform in Euro Champs versus MTGO versus, you know, LobsterCon or whatever, right? So those are kind of some of the ideas I had. I don't know if Jay or Brendan, if either of you had any other ideas?
Yeah, like, date filtering is one thing that I think would be important. I think it'd be really cool to be able to see, like, right now we just have all the data that's up in our database is just the calendar year 2024 Modo data. I think it'd be cool. I know we have access to going back even further, and I think it'll probably, like, default to the last calendar year or something, but being able to have the user set it to say, like, I'm curious, what was Replenish's win rate during 2023? And then they could compare that to 2024 and compare that to, you know, the start of 2025 or whatever, and just be able to break down, or, like, I want to see what the Mono Blue Dreadnought deck post LobsterCon has been, you know, how that's been doing. So I think date filtering will be an important thing going forward. But yeah, I mean, all the functionality is the basic functionality is certainly there, and if anybody has suggestions or whatever, certainly reach out. Always available on Twitter or Discord or whatever, and if you say, hey, I really want to see this feature, is this possible, let us know.
Let's hear it.
Yeah, to pull back the curtain a little bit, just sorry to interrupt, Billy, the way that we sort of structure things behind the scenes is based on the sort of things that people want to see and the outcomes that we want to provide. So the sooner that you get sort of requests in, the easier it is that we can bring them to you, basically.
I got your first request.
What do you got?
Logical operators.
Hit me with that Boolean.
Four. I got gold Boolean for you.
Oh, shit.
This is what I want to see more than anything. the ability to sort not by archetype, but by inclusion or disinclusion of a card. So in effect, it would be, it would almost be like sort of like the way that you define decks. So you say like, okay, when you're saying Terrigen, you're saying has Terravor, has Armageddon. Or if you're saying Blue White Stifle Knight, you're saying has Dreadnought, has Stifle, has Swords to Plowshares. I want to see that as like a user specified input, as a user specified query, which I think is the correct term, but it not sure. So I want to be able to go, how does Red Elemental Blast in sideboard perform against the format? Or how does Duress perform against decks with Counterspell but not Psychotog?
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So to be able to set my own, to like almost like Google Foo, or just use, does that make sense? I want to Scryfall it.
It's kind of what I'm describing with the query builder.
Okay.
Of like, I want to see X and Y and see.
Basically, we just need to teach Billy SQL, right?
Well, so I mean, the easy thing was send Billy a SQL video and tell him to go figure it out. But that doesn't help everyone else because we're not going to give everyone database access. So, I mean, ideally, we can build something for that. Yeah. Now, this is something I need to FITFO, as I've never done that. So.
Got it.
Okay. Yeah. But then the problem is you start injecting shit like 1=1 and getting a whole database back.
Yeah, and then Trent's going to come to us and say, oh, I did SQL injection through your query builder. Your stuff's wicked weak. You got to fix this up. You know, you guys are slacking. So
that would be great stuff for him to work on when he shows up with his complaint.
Word.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so that's actually kind of an interesting question. So y'all, are choosing to limit. What limitations are you placing on this from the public? So what does the public get to see? What is it? What's public right now?
Yeah, so the main thing that's public is a pre-calculated matchup list. That's really all that the website exists to provide. There are lots of features behind the scenes that we sort of, on the tech crew, so to speak, have access to, and that's where we do a lot of our development. And once we feel we have those things in a good place, we'll start adding those to the public facing site. So yeah, things like the query builder, things like adjusting the date range of the data or the percentage threshold cutoff of the matchup chart, you know, all these sorts of things that we have kind of in super alpha state right now will eventually start becoming publicly available.
Got it. So I'll give you some practice right now. May I have database access?
No.
Excellent.
Maybe when we make our dev instance. Development instance. So you
a sandbox for Billy to splash around and play.
Yeah. So
in.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So when you're doing development practices, you have what's called production, which is what your users see, and you have development, which is where your developers work, so that if they break something, they don't break it for the users.
Got it.
So if I were to give you database access, I'd prefer to give it to you in dev. So if you go, oops, guys, I accidentally dropped one of your tables and all the data's gone, we go, okay, well, that's not a big deal.
Okay, so you would give me a carbon copy of the website.
Exactly.
To fuck with.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I would expect that to be a fairly large... It would be a fairly large file because it would include my own private copy of the database in question.
Yeah, so it wouldn't. I mean, we could give you like a Excel sheet of the data.
I almost would be happier with an Excel spreadsheet.
Okay.
Yeah. I got you.
Yeah, we can do
that. Actually, wait, no, that's huge. I can't make any use of that.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's gonna be a lot of data.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, but but it would be more of going to a website where you can construct queries against the data.
Got it. Okay. So it would basically be saying Billy has a key that only goes so many gates in.
Exactly.
Correct.
And a properly, because I'm thinking in my head that I could make whatever queries I want, but I might say something dumb that could cause an unexpected outcome, and it's very limited what sort of I would have basically no ability to fuck with.
To fuck anything.
to fuck anything.
Right, so like as Jay put it, the term's sandbox.
Okay.
You can play in the sandbox all you want, no matter what you do.
Got it. Yeah. Which is where a very stupid 5-year-old wants.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, like, are you familiar with virtual machines?
Nope.
All right, fair enough.
I'm fucking with it. A little bit.
So,
yes.
Sometimes if you want to fuck with, like, dangerous, you know, like malware, for example.
I don't.
You would, if you did, you would boot up a virtual machine that is basically a computer inside your computer so that you can fuck that computer to death.
Okay.
And
to put it lightly.
Yeah, to put it lightly. And guess what? If it dies, who cares?
Spoilers for Nosferatu.
Yeah. Fuck.
I haven't seen that yet. Yes.
We have to put a massive spoiler alert at the beginning of the
episode. Yeah, spoilers. Spoilers for Nosferatu.
Spoiler alert. This episode contains spoilers for Nosferatu.
You guys fuck with Eggers' other stuff?
Oh, dude. One of my favorite directors.
Hell yeah. Probably my favorite. His set design.
I love The Witch, dude.
The Witch, so sick.
Banger.
We watched at the Duress Crew holiday party. We watched The Northman.
That movie is sleeper hit, man. It's so good. And no one talks about it.
It's a lot. It's a lot. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot.
Hey, I think it's his worst movie, but it's still good.
Yeah, probably.
I didn't like the...
Lighthouse is weird, man.
Lighthouse is... that... The Lighthouse has probably the single most jaw-dropping scene in all of cinema. When I saw it in theaters, and I just, like, looked around, and y'all know the scene that I'm talking about, and everybody's mouths and jaws were just all the way open. Like, what like, the
this
fuck?
Is happening right now?
Like, Willem!
I love that movie, too.
That was a lot.
All those movies are.
Yeah, The Witch was a lot, but The Witch was so cool good. Because the set design and also the linguistics of it.
I had to raw dog that movie in theaters, no subtitles, bro. I had no clue of what the dad was saying that entire fucking movie, dude.
Yeah, what is it?
I will not be judged by false Christians. Yeah, that's so the only hard. Line I got from him.
Yeah, so sick. Yeah.
All right.
Damn dog.
Back on track.
Anyways, tangent.
Okay, if we don't have any other questions, I want to go over some interesting data before we start looking to close this episode out.
Hell yeah.
I'm interested.
All right. So, I want to point out some things that I found interesting. I'm going to start off with the top five decks that are by win rate, and a couple points that, like, in the data that I was like, whoa, I didn't expect that. And you guys are obviously welcome to throw anything in as you've seen it. But we're going to start off with the top five by win rate here. Number one, by no shock, is Mob Blue Dreadnought, the 61.4% win rate. Second, Black Green Survival at 61.1% win rate. This was like a huge shocker to me. I did not expect the deck to be that high.
How many matches?
I don't have the match. I didn't write the match numbers down.
340 matches.
340 matches.
350
matches. I take that serious. Not insanely, but like that is a worthy
data set. It's impressive because it's second.
Not malarkey. Yeah.
You know what's number three, Billy? Terrageddon.
Yeah.
60% win rate.
Yep.
I don't have, again, I'll match numbers, but
they're 500 matches.
Hang on. I saw this on the thing. What is its matchup with Mono Blue Dreadnought?
It is Terrageddon versus Mono Blue Dreadnought 40%?
40%. Just saying, nobody else is on Meddling Mage and Red
Blast.
Play fucking both and fuck on them.
Yep.
It's going to be great.
And that's the point of this tool, right?
Yes.
You look at it, you go, oh, well, this has a shit matchup here. How can I adjust, right?
You need both or else you're 40%.
So number four, blah, 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 is Replenish. 59.4%, whatever. And then number five is Elves at 57.9%.
Tier three deck.
Tier three deck. Let's go.
How many matches is Elves?
And I got to give an honorable mention.
About 500.
500 matches.
Yeah.
500.
All right.
15.
I got to give an honorable shout out to the sleeper hit Survival Madness. Number six.
Wow.
56.6% win rate. Shout out to Stanley Chen.
Yeah, I was gonna say, let's be real.
Could you just put Stanley Chen on that matchup matrix?
Yeah, let's be real. Cyberpunker has a 56.6% win rate. Like,
that was crazy to me.
Yeah, this has got to be, I would guess,
higher than Goblins, higher than Sly.
I would guess he is 80% of those matches.
Oh, he's banned probably, yeah.
Survival.
Yeah.
Banned survival.
Banned survival of the fittest.
Three of the top six.
That's what you're hearing.
And only two are tied decks.
As far as data goes, that I was like, other data points that I was like surprised with that I looked at, like me being an Elves player, I instantly looked at that data. And Elves actually has it's only 16 matches. But I'm almost all of the losses, I can tell you that right now, because I've played in a lot of these. Versus Green-Red Oath was 50% win rate. Which means that if I'm at least six of those losses. So that means there's other Elf players that know how to beat Green-Red Oath, and I'm just really bad at that. So that, like, that's a learning point for myself, that even if it's a small data set, that there's something I'm doing totally wrong. You know? Was there any other data points that you guys thought were interesting, like, when you were looking through it at all?
What is the most lopsided matchup?
Elves has a 100% win rate against Stasis.
Enchantress for Punish has got to be pretty bad.
Enchantress or Planet Punish is like 90%.
It's got to be.
Replenish.
Replenish over Enchantress was 95% at 19 and 1.
That match is a nightmare.
It's really, really bad for Enchantress.
I've been on the wrong side of that one quite a few times.
It is probably one of the highest that is like over a certain threshold. I mean, Sly 30% versus Survival Madness over 31 matches. There's a bunch on here that, you know, it's aren't great. Obviously, you have a bunch of, like, Survival Rock versus The Rock is 4-0. So that's 100%.
Yeah. Right.
Hooray. But how much does that actually mean?
We don't know.
What's Sly versus Goblins? That's, like, Sly versus Goblins is, like, the debate topic.
How'd that work? 31 and 37 for Sly, so a 45.6% win rate.
For Sly is disfavored?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, Goblins is slightly favored.
But it's still, like, fairly close.
It is.
Okay. All right.
And I think, again, it is important to note that this is all on Modo.
Right.
A certain type of player plays on Modo.
Yep.
Those types of players tend to skew their deck selection certain ways. And also, there are certain archetypes that are just not represented on Modo. I mean, I believe Volrath Shapeshifter is still bugged, right?
Yeah, that's so, like, a very good point.
You know, Feb is just not represented.
Feb's missing.
In all of this data. And again, I do wish I had confidence intervals calculated out, but, like, even at, you know, several hundred matches played, it's still a several percentage point swing of, like, what the quote-unquote true matchup percentage would be. So take everything with a grain of salt. But it is definitely worth noting that, like, there are some decks that are potentially quote-unquote problematic. I think anybody that is looking at, like, oh, there's just one card that needs to be banned, whether that's Tide or whatever.
Or Survival.
I think is kind of crazy, just because, according to the data, there's either a lot that's problematic or not that much that's problematic.
I'd be interested to see, like, what... So we set the cutoff at 2% of the meta.
Yep. Yeah.
I would be very interested to see, like, matchup. Okay, so how many decks do we have that met that criteria? Like 16 or so?
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12,
13, 14, 15, 16. So there's 16 decks. I'm not certain how to describe this succinctly or mathematically, but there's a spread of matchups in there. Some of them are 100% and 0%.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, let's say the format was all, like, very rock, paper, scissors. So it was, like, or just, like an expanded version of that, where you have 100% loss, 100% win.
Mm-hmm.
Completely,
polarized.
Yeah, by
bipolar distribution?
Bifurcated?
Bimodal?
Bimodal, thank
yes,
you.
Bimodal, yes.
Perfectly bimodal. I'd be interested to see what pre-modern is as a format as compared to another format. Like, Dandan is, like, definitionally, like, anti-bimodal, because it's, right. like, same mirror, same deck, blah, blah, blah. It would be, like, perfectly modal, monomodal, yeah. non-modal, whatever. But I would be interested to see how what the variance is in pre-modern, because then it's like, oh, this is a very matchup-specific format, whereas, like, in my brain, a perfect format would be all decks all have a 50% win rate, and it's all skill-diffing, and, like, who got mana screwed and who didn't, if that makes sense.
Well, those two things are inherently... I mean, if first off, if everything was inherently, was purely skill-diffing people, then mana screw and, you know, oh, I flooded out wouldn't be a thing.
Yeah, I'm not certain how to describe it, but I mean to say, like, so we have the what pre-modern variance, matchup predictability variance as compared to other formats.
Sure.
Does that make sense
when I'm trying to describe? Like, how big of a roller coaster are you on?
Exactly. When how much of your tournament outcome is determined
by deck selection versus
by deck selection, exactly.
As opposed to just magic happened and variance happened.
Because there's kind of, I think of magic as having kind of three components. One is like deck selection before the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's how your deck got shuffled, mm-hmm. and then there's how you played mm-hmm. the matchup.
For sure.
People think it's really just two variables, but I think there it could, if you're going to break it up into a a three variable system,
for sure.
It would be deck choice, how your deck got shuffled that day, with, you know, mana flood, mana screw, and mm-hmm. then skill.
Right.
And I would be interested to see what deck selection does as compared to other formats.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's a whole another depth. That's just
I'm not entirely interesting. Sure how you could...
Yeah,
but
we would need to
saying,
do this the fuck over again, and then you would have to let me sit and do some math.
Yeah.
I think while you were talking, Brendan was looking up how many decks we would get if we, like, excluded the 2% and went down to, say, 1%.
Yeah.
Did you...
So, it's about 25 decks if we went down to 1% metagame.
Okay. Are there any decks that are, like, notably named or included?
I would say one that's right on the fringe is Stasis.
Okay.
Locally, that's one that makes a ton of appearances. I don't really know how widespread it is sort of in the wider meta, but that's one that's right on the cusp there.
And I think that would skyrocket because, like, this is where the Modo factor comes in because on Modo, if you run out of time, you just lose.
Yeah.
So, like, playing Stasis is a little riskier than playing it in paper.
Got it.
Yeah, interesting. That's another good point. Devourer combo, Dead Guy Ale, Reanimator, Mono Blue Storm, Machine Head. Those are really the ones that are right sort of on the cusp there.
Yeah, Machine Head notably is 1.9.
So 1.9.
Right.
Do any of those stand out as, like, sleeper because they're unpublished but actually, like, really good?
I feel like Stasis is a good example of that.
Stasis is a deck that it kind of goes to what you were just saying, and that it does have very polarizing matchups.
Okay.
Right. So Stasis is 1.85%, and its worst matchup is 4.26. You know.
Yeah.
Which is elves. So it's like people play elves on Modo because it's more affordable. It's easier to get the deck assembled. So that's maybe another reason people don't play Stasis on there. It's just riskier.
And that's one thing I mentioned earlier, but I want to reiterate is that I hope people don't look at these sort of overall percentages as kind of like the be-all, end-all, is that even if Stasis has, you know, a 20% or 30% matchup against some archetype, if you're playing in a metagame where that deck doesn't exist, those numbers don't matter.
Right.
So ideally, this should be ammo for you to decide what way you want to attack a certain environment and not necessarily to just believe in these numbers as, you know, the holy gospel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this should be a it should be a weapon in your arsenal, not a reason to complain at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I think more importantly, not a reason to stay home.
Also
I think
true.
There's plenty of of decks that you can find a home with and still do pretty well in this format.
I'd be interested to find out. It's pretty easy to calculate. Just go on MTG Top 8, look at a representative deck, and then you can probably find out, like, wins per dollar.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That seems like a pretty interesting thing. Like, holy shit, like, you can win a lot of fucking games for, you know, like, $65 with black-white control or something like that.
Mm-hmm. That's actually an incredibly good idea.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, whereas the Top 8 data doesn't have matchups and win rate, we do. So, right. Yeah, the more data we get, the more accurate of a number we can give for, yeah, people who are new to the format or just want to try something out. Yeah, so, for example, this is a really good example. The black-green survival deck, I think, is like 15 tickets on Moto or something like that. It's insanely inexpensive, and it's a super good deck. So
yeah.
There's plenty of fun that can be had for not having to play with LEDs and box diamonds and all that.
Yeah, the only RL card in that deck is banned everywhere else.
Yeah, it's completely useless in every other format. Yeah.
Elves definitely has like a negative wins per dollar.
Yeah.
It's yeah. Like you're paying a lot to maybe not do so hot.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's a good segue into starting to close out our episode. And I wanted to have a little bit of a segment, like Jay talked about a little bit earlier, on how you, the listener, can help us make this better. How to grow the data, how to make this more of a useful tool than it already is. One of the easiest ways you can do that is if you just start playing on Modo. Go to premodernseries.org, check out the CPL, it's called CPS now. Hit up Chris DiBiase, aka Iron Lugs, get on there, play some matches. We're going to be collecting data from there. You can be a part of this data if you like. TOs, we need match data. We don't need anything fancy. I just need to know that two players played, ideally their names, and it doesn't have to be included right there, their deck list. I can take care of the rest. That's all I need. It's very helpful. We can get that data in here ASAP.
Yeah, any format you can give it to us is totally fine. We'll take care of it.
I would actually prefer if you don't label archetypes and just give us deck lists so we can standardize on things. So that would be ideal. Like I mentioned before, we're working with several other folks on different data, European data. I'm working with Flippy, supposed to be getting German national data. We're going to be getting our own data. Anyone, if you're using Spice Rack, it should be very easy for you to get me the data. So if you're using it, just hit me up and I can help you get that. I'd love to import it, and all you got to do is just send it to me. You don't have to do any work on your end. So just going into our outro, just trying to get at it, like trying to end this. Do you guys have any other comments? Anything else you want to add before I start getting the shout-outs or anything else?
Yes.
Yes.
It's called Australian dry rub because you cook the chicken upside down.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying, Billy. Yeah, you know, I was really at the edge of my seat here.
Yes. It keeps the breast meat more moist. And you don't... I don't know. If you're into crispy chicken, cook that chicken in the Northern Hemisphere. If you're into the chicken skin on the breast... But it's called Australian dry rib because it's an upside down chicken. It's very important.
Just as like a random throwaway comment, I've just sort of started getting back into Magic after a long time, and I was always sort of a tournament player, you know, like go X and 3 at regionals or states or whatever, like maybe very slightly above average player, but like I was able to help out and do something cool in a way that like doesn't involve me winning a tournament or something like that. And I want to say that everyone that was involved with this just like took the bull by the horns, and it didn't matter whether they had, you know, a bunch of experience doing something, like they just got in there and did it. And I really hope that can be an example for people who feel like they have sort of a unique thing that they can offer or some skill or something like that. Like, even though we're on a podcast, like there's a million podcasts, but there's not a lot of data analysis or there's not a lot of whatever like unique skill that you have. So I just hope it inspires people to sort of just get in there and do something cool.
Hell yeah.
FITFO.
So
yeah, if you want to see the data, you can go see it live at data.derescrew.com. The numbers I said on this episode might be different, so please don't DM me and say, Nick, you're wrong in the episode. It's actually this percent. Well, it might be different because we're getting the data consistently. As far as giving feedback, I feel like I have to say this, unfortunately. please don't message anyone here saying you don't like what we're doing. That doesn't help anyone, and we're going to tell you to fuck off, so please don't do that.
We're going
to
do it anyway.
Yeah, if you're, we're going to do it anyways. I don't care what you think about it. If you want to message us and say, hey, I got a great idea for this, or have you considered this, or why aren't you doing this, that's great. I love to hear it. Please, my DMs are open. You know where to find me. I'm on Discord, Twitter, all that, at Duress Crew. Shout-outs. Got a bunch of shout-outs for you guys, so sit tight. Our regional, March 1st, has sold out in, we'll say 4 days, but it was really almost like 3 days. It was there was one slot going into today, and no one claimed it all day. It sold out. 108 players, March 1st. Whitensville match. If you want to catch it, check it out on twitch.tv/duresscrew. We're going to be expanding our charity raffle online. So if you would like to participate in those, please keep your eyes and ears open in the Pre-Modern Discord. Follow us on Twitter. Find me on Facebook. DM me. Whatever. We'll keep you posted about it. Shout-outs to Gatherling for facilitating this entire thing. I know if some rando hit me up asking to use my API, I'd probably tell them to kick rocks and go do something else. And they were very welcoming and really helpful and, like, get letting us even do this entire project and let our vision come to light. Signups for a Spice Paradise Season 2 hosted by Phil Nguyen, the legendary MTG banding, are now live until I believe the end of this month. I want to say the 25th or so, 19th or something. I don't know, somewhere near the end of this month. If you are someone who is looking to play a little bit on the spicy side, more brews, some rogue decks, definitely check that out. You can find the information on that on the Discord or by hitting him up on Twitter or in Discord. Rochester Royals Winter Ball 2025 coming up. It's going to be on January 25th. They have 40 people registered for the pre-modern event. We'll be there. We'll be playing. They have a legacy and old school side event. Definitely register for that. It's all for charity. You get some barbecue for registering. Proxies are legal. It's all good.
First place is a Magic the Gathering carpet, which is the sickest prize for any tournament I've ever heard of.
Like, we're going to go win a carpet.
Wait, and a carpet? I didn't know that either.
100%. It's literally a carpet, bro.
That's insane.
Was it the person who made the Hypnotic Spectre carpet?
Maybe. I didn't know about that.
At LobsterCon, the LobsterCon raffle.
I don't remember that.
Wasn't there, like, a fucking sick carpet? Like, a rug?
I believe you. I just don't remember
it. A tapestry.
But either case, yeah, it's sounds sick. Sweet. I'm really excited to go.
Hell yeah. But we're going to win it, so don't.
Yeah, so don't get too don't get too excited.
I won't need a carpet. I'll be busy wiping my feet on the competition.
So, Pre-Modern is coming back to Misty Mountain. Misty Mountain Games in Madison, Wisconsin. Homie of the crew, BK, Brian Kowal, is hosting an event. It's going to be a charity event starting at 11 a.m. Be $40 to enter. Lunch is included. Live coverage, all that good stuff. Definitely go check it out. I know I wouldn't be as inspired to do live coverage of Pre-Modern if it wasn't for the folks out in Madison, like Mike and BK. For our friends in the north in Canada, their Boreal Pre-Modern is hosting an event on February 22nd. $40 Canadian.
Announced like $6.
Yeah, I think that's like, I don't know, dude. I think it's like free.
Give or take.
Hosted by our friend Patrick Burt. Definitely check that out if you're in Ottawa. And any other details for these events, you can find them in the Pre-Modern Discord. Go to the announcements channel. You'll be able to find links to registration and all that good stuff. Any closing comments, gentlemen?
I just want to thank, yeah, and kind of touch on what Brenda was saying a few minutes ago, that, you know, it has been fantastic working on another project with you guys, and I just want to say much love to all of you guys, because yeah, it's amazing to just have an idea and be like, could we do this, and then actually do it and not just infinitely talk about things and hope that one day maybe they'll just magically appear, but instead actually have people that have drive and want to see things get done. So yeah, thank you to all of you guys.
This is one of my favorite things about the crew. It's our motivation to get stuff done. You know, someone says, hey, starts off with Brad saying, wouldn't it be cool if we had this? And we said, okay, wait, we have the resources for us. Let's make it happen.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
All right, y'all. Well, thank you for tuning in with us tonight. This is your Hardcast host, Nick Mayo, signing off.
Brendan O'Dowd, we'll see you later.
Hello, Mills Kern. See you later.
Jay McCallum.
Peace. Later.